The hatch closed with the handle of a shovel. She backed up out of the shed, taking the tarps with her as she went. One last thing. The axe. It was on the floor where Sebastian had dropped it. She forced herself to look as she wiped it, picked it up in a bin bag, covering it so the others couldn't see. She stepped out of the woodshed and walked several yards back, to the stream that wound through the woods into the garden. She shook it out of the bag, dropping it into the water, kicking at it until it was entirely submerged. She stared at the axe for a moment, peacefully resting there among the rocks. Reality fragmented for a moment. She was cleaning up a murder scene. Rosie. Noel. She had a mental flash of Rosie's body under the wood. "Keep it together, Theo," she said to herself. "You're going to be a doctor. You do whatever needs to be done to help others. You have to do this." She shook her head forcefully, as if trying to knock the picture out of her mind. It worked, at least enough for her to pick up her chin and march back to where the others were loading the cars. "Where do we go with these?" Yash said, regarding the bags. "The woods?"
"They might search," Peter said. "They might find them. There's a lot of woods. There's probably going to be a lot of police."
Peter and Yash refining each other's ideas even now.
"A few miles up the road," Angela said. "There was a skip by some construction. I saw it as we drove in. Some building site close to the pub. We could take them there, drop them in with the other rubbish."
Everyone agreed that this was the correct thing to do.
"Who feels like they can drive?" Theo asked.
"I think I could," Julian said. "I have no idea why or how, but I think I could."
"You five, go. Get rid of the bags and drive to the shops and get bread or milk or sauce rolls or something. So if anyone says they saw a car leave here in the morning, there'll be a good reason. While you're gone, we'll call the police. Once we start this, we need to stay together on it, not just today. Always. Do we agree?"
One by one, each of the group nodded their assent. Julian, Suze, Angela, Peter, and Yash backed out of the driveway with their terrible cargo, leaving Theo and Sebastian. And Rosie and Noel.
Theo reached for Sebastian's hand. The stage was set. Ready or not, showtime always came. You had to go on, even if you felt underprepared.
22. The fire crackled and licked the dark air. The clock on the mantel did its part and made a gentle, slow heartbeat sound. The nine circulated a look. They spoke wordlessly to each other. It was weird how they could have an entire conversation this way. Stevie could feel it, even if she couldn't hear it. Her butt was way too hot. She stepped forward a bit.
"I didn't start putting it all together until dinner," Stevie said. "I didn't know what I was looking at first. But a few things got me thinking. If you hadn't said plant-based so many times, I don't think it would have occurred to me what Angela was really saying. Plants. Then I started thinking about all the things Sebastian told me when we were outside, that he used to smoke a lot of weed. He learned about plants from the gardener. When you add it all up, plants, weed, the window closed one day and open after the murder, the rope missing from the pull, it all equals..."
"Grow house," David said, breaking into a smile.
Nothing from the assembled. Too much nothing. She had stepped out into the void and... Then someone sighed.
"This is my fault," Theo said.
"Don't you dare, Theo,"
Sebastian said.
"If it's anyone's fault, it's mine."
"It sounds like it was mine," Suze added. "Maybe it was my subconscious talking."
"It's not anyone's fault," Peter said. "No one's fault. It was what we had to do," Julian concluded.
And she had landed on solid ground. Across the room, David had a strange look on his face. Not a smile, exactly. A kind of grimace of amazement.
"Do you know where my aunt is?" Izzy said to them.
Everyone shook their head. A chorus of no's.
"We don't,"
Theo said. If we knew, trust us.
We would be there, Suze said. We want to know as much as you do. This, the cannabis...
It has nothing to do with it,
Peter said.
Nothing. There's no harm in explaining now, Sebastian said. You seem to have a handle on the situation. And it's all down to me anyway. You're right. I had cannabis plants up there. Not many. I put in some lights and fans and grew a few plants, barely anything. I'd pick some up when I visited home. When we came upon the scene that morning, saw the door ripped open, the first thing that occurred to me was that someone must have found out and had come to steal the plants.
And had they? Stevie said.
No,
Sebastian replied.
Nothing had been taken. We just found Rosie and Noel. So we got rid of the plants before the police arrived.
Carefully, Theo added. We tried to disrupt as little as possible. When we got there, the floor was soaked. There were puddles of water everywhere, so there were no footprints. We still used other objects to avoid stepping on the ground. We removed everything from upstairs, very carefully, and got rid of it. The only things we altered downstairs were the axe and the rope handle.
Where was the axe when you arrived? Stevie asked.
Exactly where it always was,
Sebastian said,
standing upright by the door. It had a long handle, so I'd use it to hook the rope pull. That's what I did that morning. I grabbed it and pulled the hatch down. I didn't see Rosie and Noel until I had come back down the ladder.
We had to cut the rope handle because it had blood on it, Theo continued,
and the police might go up there and find residue of the plants. We had to clean the axe because Sebastian's fingerprints were on it. We cleaned the handle and threw it in the stream. I've never regretted what we did that day. We couldn't help Rosie or Noel, but we could help Sebastian. If those plants had been found, he would have gone to jail, and maybe he would have been accused of murder.
No regrets, Suze said.
This was generally echoed around the room.
And my aunt knew, Izzy said.
Of course, Theo replied. It was all of us. She helped.
All of us, Suze said.
Every one of us,
Peter added.
We used a brigade system to take the plants down. We loaded them into a car and got rid of them.
And then I phoned the police, Theo said, as quickly as I could.
And what about the lock on the shed? Stevie asked.
What we said about that was true,
Sebastian said.
We found the lock intact and the door ripped open. Must have been easier for the burglars to crowbar it open rather than mess about with the lock.
Stevie had to move away from the fire. It was too much heat. She moved to the darker side of the room, nearer to where David was perched.
Question,
Yash said, raising his hand slightly.
You still haven't explained why you have crime scene photos and police reports.
My aunt had them, Izzy said. We found them in her house. She's been researching this case.
You mean she's looking for the burglars?
Yash replied.
For some DNA evidence or something? She never mentioned this to me. Did she say anything to any of you?
A chorus of shaking heads.
If Angela is researching the case, Suze said, is that where she is? I mean, she'd have to be here, right? Where else could she look? And why not just tell us she was doing it?
Because she thinks one of you did it, Stevie thought.
What does she have?
Julian asked.
What did she learn?
Only what the police knew at the time, Stevie said. She has the photos, the statements, the notes, the coroner's report.
The entire police file,
Julian said. And one other thing, who is Samantha Gravis?
Six blank looks.
Who?
Suze asked. This was in with the police file. Stevie pulled out the newspaper article and passed it around.
I don't know who this is,
Julian said.
Nor do I,
Theo said, passing it to Sebastian, who shrugged. Peter and Yash held the clipping between them and studied it.
You know, Peter said, there's something, vaguely something I can't place.
Yash frowned in thought. The others crowded around the sofa. Suze leaned low over the back of the sofa, her elbows on her friend's shoulders.
Well, the article is dated the day we arrived in Merriweather. June 23rd, 1995,
she said.
That was also the day that Rosie and Noel were killed.
They all conferred, trying to make sense of it. Their confused buzz seemed genuine. They really did not seem to know who Samantha Gravis was, and they wanted to figure it out. Stevie was on the verge of asking something when Janelle appeared in the doorway.
Dr. Quinn was just on the phone, she said. Can I talk to you for a second?
Stevie ushered Janelle to the far side of the entrance hall, under the disapproving portrait of the man and his dog. This made Stevie too nervous and was still within hearing distance of the sitting room, so she motioned them into the library and shut the door. She slapped at the wall, looking for the light switch, but was unable to find it. This talk would have to happen in the dark, which suited Stevie just fine.
Figured some stuff out, Stevie said, in there, about what happened.
I heard, Janelle replied quietly.
There was no, great job, Stevie, or you're brilliant, or this makes everything fine.
So I'm getting closer, Stevie said quickly.
Not there yet, but if we figure out who Samantha Gravis is.
You did hear me say that Dr. Quinn was on the phone, right?
Stevie sucked in her lips and bit down hard.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't pick up in time, Janelle went on, so she called Nate. I heard Nate saying that we were in the student lounge watching a movie, and since we're not in a student lounge watching a movie.
The wind was picking up outside, and the trees were running the tips of their bare branches on the house, skinny fingertips tapping and scraping. There was a hollow whistle from the fireplace.
Okay. Stevie breathed out the word in a violent exhale. I can explain. Nate already did. I was trying to find a time to tell you that you lied and said we had permission to come to this house when Dr. Quinn actually thinks we're in London.
Yeah,
Stevie said, curling in on herself a little.
But you know why I did it.
Nothing from Janelle for a moment. The dark library may have been a bad choice for this discussion. The windows were tall and cast long rectangles of moonlight on the floor. The books stood as silent sentinels, witnesses to Stevie's shame. There was some kind of threatening piece of art nearby, something with beady eyes. The air smelled faintly of furniture polish, book dust, and judgment.
I know why you think you did it, Janelle said. You think you did it because you had to help Angela and you had to get us all here any way you could.
You said you wouldn't come if Quinn said no, Stevie shot back.
But don't lie,
Janelle countered, an edge of emotion in her voice.
You should have told me what she said. Vi didn't know. When did you tell Nate?
When we got here, Stevie said quietly.
I guess David knew, not that it matters for him. He doesn't have to answer to Quinn.
I didn't tell him either, Stevie said.
But you know.
You know why I had to lie.
No, Janelle said. I know that you did it, but you didn't have to. If I can't trust my friends, if I can't trust you, who can I trust?
Stevie's eyes burned with tears. She coughed and thumbed them away.
I'm stupid for lying to you, she said, but I'm honestly scared for Angela, and here, this is the only place to find out what happened to her, so I did a shitty thing. I'm a shitty friend, but for a good reason.
Did lying to us get you closer to finding Angela? Janelle said.
I'm closer. She's out there somewhere, and she's in trouble, and there isn't a me without us. Angela needs us.
She landed on the us as hard as she could. It was true. There was no Stevie without Janelle and Nate and Vi and David. They were one, like those people in the other room. They were an organism, a system. Even in the dark room, Stevie could see Janelle's cheerful yellow sweater, her neat wrap of braids in an orange and brown scarf, bright yet autumnal, always in the moment. The friend who backed her at every turn, who fixed the broken things, who did the hard math, the person you could go to in the middle of the night. Janelle's stance softened a little. She was always sensitive to people who needed help.
You know, she said, if you'd told me what Quinn actually said, we'd have figured it out. It's not like I don't care that Angela could be hurt. I was mad at you for screwing around. If you'd told me, we could have come up with a solution together.
but you didn't trust me.
I trust you, Stevie said. With anything, I just didn't know what to do.
What do I do to make it up to you?
Janelle sighed.
You tell me the truth, Janelle said.
Lies are poison. But Stevie, we only have a little over a day left here in England.
So you have what, 36 hours?
I believe in you, but this one, there may be no time.
You may have to leave it to someone else to find her. That's just reality.
Is there anything specific you think you can do in that time to work it out?
The answer to that question was no. No, Stevie did not know what came next. She never did. The moves always came to her as she worked out the puzzle. There was no advance plan, no method, no organized way of dealing with this.
Tomorrow, Janelle said softly. We go back to London. We do what's on our schedule. We have our tea. We go to the theater. We finish our trip.
We can't screw up our lives on hunches, Stevie. We need to plan, and we need to trust each other.
The words landed hard, each one in her gut.
I won't do it again, Stevie said. I promise.
You better, Janelle replied. Then, after a long moment, she added,
But you did good in there.
You're lucky you're so smart.
I'm lucky I have you.
You're right, but don't push it, Janelle replied.
It came out stern, but Stevie could hear the smile on her face. 23. Stevie had exhausted her mental resources for the evening. Between her revelations and the talk with Janelle, she had nothing left. She wanted to burrow into the massive bed upstairs and sleep. Sleep for a week. She stepped out into the shadowy main hall, where David was waiting on the steps.
I've missed these kinds of nights, he said. You solve everything, all hell breaks loose. Usually we end up in a hole or something, too. We're making out well tonight.
Stevie had no energy for the banter. She sat next to him on the step. By craning her neck forward, she could see that the conversation in the sitting room was still engaged. Photos were still being passed around.
Quinn didn't say yes to you coming here, huh?
He said in a low voice.
Not exactly, Stevie said.
You never change, he said.
You mean I'm a shithead?
Take that however you want. It's not the word I'd choose.
Seems to fit, she said. But what else was I supposed to do?
Instead of replying, he took her hand. Using his thumb, he made slow, soft circles in her palm. It was reassurance. It was love. This tiny gesture also made every nerve in her body stand at attention. There was a quiver, a gentle, repeated note, like an orchestra warming up. A rising energy. The anxiety and exhaustion converted into something more liquid. Emotional catharsis. Also, horniness, plain and gloriously simple.
Can we go upstairs now? She asked quietly.
David stood, and the look in his eye told her everything. They did not turn on the lights. They didn't even make it that far into Stevie's room. As soon as the door was shut, David turned. She moved first, with a hungry, nervous energy, kissing him hard and accidentally bumping his head against the wall. To her delight, he scooped her up and took her over to the bed, dropping her the last foot. She bounced gently. He hopped up, tenting himself over her. She thought he was about to lean in and kiss her. She was ready to go the full Bridgerton here at Merryweather. But he was just hovering there, looking at her with a faint smile.
The other night, he said. I think you were going to ask me if I'd ever had sex, weren't you?
To her surprise, her awkwardness with the question had gone.
Yes, she replied.
But you didn't ask. What answer did you want?
The real one, because I'm guessing yes.
That's the right answer,
he said.
There was a little twinge inside her, part upset and part satisfaction. It was okay. It was a little strange. It was good.
It was all those things at once.
A lot?
She asked. David laughed, but not unpleasantly.
What's a lot?
Did you win any awards for most sex? A real laugh this time. He got off his hands and knees and rolled next to her, so they were face to face on the pillow.
My last girlfriend before I went to Ellingham, he said. And once at Ellingham. Well, not at Ellingham. I went to Burlington with Ellie for a party. I met someone there. It was just the once.
Ellie. Their friend from Ellingham. It was odd to talk about her this way, out of context of all the terrible things that had happened there.
Is there anything specific you want to know?
I don't think so, she said. Not right now.
What about you?
He said, propping himself up on his elbow. Do you really need to ask?
I mean, I think the answer is no, but I'm asking.
You think right?
Are you asking for a reason?
I think so. He considered this for a moment.
Okay, he said. Do you want to talk about that? Because we should talk about that before.
Yeah, she said. But I've thought about it. And would you want to? A short laugh.
Yeah, he said. Of course, but we don't have to. We can do whatever. I'm saying yes. I'm also saying that whatever you decide is good with me. You know what I'm saying.
There was a little nervousness there now that was unlike him. She looked at his face, which was framed in the squares of pale moonlight coming through the glass. If not now, when? This was about as ideal a time as she'd ever hoped for. This was what she had thought about and considered and researched. I'm saying yes, she said.
Tonight or in general in the future?
Tonight, she said. Now.
I brought condoms, he said. I didn't say anything.
Where are they? He reached into his back pocket and produced a small package.
If you say stop, we stop. Talk to me. And we don't have to, just so we're super clear on this.
Same. Now that they'd had the discussion, they were left for a moment looking into each other's faces on the pillow. For a moment, she thought the spell was broken. But then they both burst out laughing at the same time. People made out like this stuff was so serious. It wasn't. It was stupid and fun. It was taking turns rolling on top of each other, biting ears and kissing necks and getting stuck in your own clothes trying to get them off. It was feeling muscles moving under skin, feeling the warmth under the covers. She didn't know precisely how it was all supposed to go, but she was getting an inkling that was growing all the time. She was vaguely aware of noises in the hallway, but they didn't matter. She was gone, out of the mansion, in some kind of skyscape made of David's hair and the inside of the covers. Nothing mattered, not the future or college or anything but... There was a knocking on the door, a strong, steady knock that increased in urgency. Who is it? Stevie finally called, breathless. The person responded by throwing open the door. Suze stood there in a long red dressing gown over royal blue pajamas with a pattern of leaping tigers.
I know who... Oh!
She looked at the two of them together, blinked in confusion, then shielded her eyes as a nod toward privacy.
I thought you said come in. So sorry.
She stepped back out of view, but kept the door open a crack.
It is important, though. You've got to come downstairs. I know who Samantha Gravis is.
Suze gathered the residents of Merriweather in the kitchen rather than the sitting room. She had roused the entirety of the house, including Janelle, Vi, and Nate. Everyone else was wearing, if not formal sleepwear, then something generally presentable. David had pulled on his Yale sweatpants and his t-shirt. Stevie had grabbed the closest thing at hand, her sex hoodie.
Oh,
Janelle said, noting the onesie that Stevie was wearing, now well zipped. While modest enough, it had never been intended for a wide audience. She wondered if she was still flushed, still sweating. She could feel moisture at the base of her neck. Her hair was probably standing on end.
Luckily, no one cared what Stevie looked like. They had all been roused and brought around to the table where Suze's laptop was open.
I couldn't get to sleep, Suze said. I was thinking about everything that happened tonight, and the face of the girl in the newspaper. I was sure I had seen her before, so I looked through my photos. It took a while, since I have so many, but I found her.
She indicated a scan of a photo that she had pulled up. There were members of the Nine, young and shiny-faced, with their 90s hair and communal clothes, lined up against the bar at a pub. Behind them were the decorative handles of the beer taps, and a bartender caught unawares by the camera, his eyes glowing red as he looked up from filling a glass. On the far end was Sebastian, his eyes closed in a squint and preening for the camera. Theo was tucked under his arm, smiling at something or someone out of view. Noel, tall and slouched, in oversized glasses and a flop of dark hair. Angela was next to him, thrusting a flower in the direction of the camera like a sword. Peter wore a green and blue striped rugby shirt and had his head thrown back in laughter, while Yash had his mouth open and his hand out in a wide gesture, still in the middle of telling a joke. Only Julian tried to work the camera at all, a half-smile on his lips. He wore a loose t-shirt and had a flannel shirt tied around his waist. There was one more person, far to the edge of the frame. An afterthought who almost didn't make the cut. She looked away slightly, but her face was clear enough. She wore an oversized Oxford sweatshirt. Suze pointed to her.
There she is, Suze said. The Canadian.
What?
Yash almost dropped his mug of tea. He hurried over and leaned in to look at the screen. Canadian? Stevie repeated. She went in for a look, but the members of the Nine had crowded around Suze and her computer. Yash scraped back one of the wooden chairs and sat down.
The Canadian, he repeated, rubbing his forehead.
My God.
Why do you keep saying she's Canadian? Stevie asked.
Because she told us she was Canadian, Suze replied.
It used to be a thing, Theo explained. Some people weren't overly fond of Americans, so some Americans would say they were Canadian instead. Can't really tell the difference. American and Canadian accents sound the same to us, generally.
Okay, Stevie said. Who is the Canadian? I mean, Samantha. She's Samantha. But how did you know her?
We didn't, Peter said.
Well, we did in a way, Theo added, but not really, like Peter says.
We did,
Yash said.
I did.
Julian certainly did, Suze cut in.
It was like they were talking in riddles.
In our last week or so at Cambridge, Suze said, during exams or right after, sometime around that period, we were all at the pub one night, and we met the Canadian, the American, Samantha. I don't think we knew her name, did we? We called her something else.
Monty,
Yash said.
Because she was Canadian, and I said something about Mounties, and she thought I said Monty or something. It was just one of those things that happen in a pub. She probably told us her name, but we called her Monty. She seemed to like it. It made her laugh.
I took the picture, Suze said. And you can see we're all in it except for Rosie, which means this happened on the night Julian cheated on her.
Julian lifted his head.
Suze, do you have to? I'm trying to explain. Rosie was out studying for an exam or doing a lab or something, and we were all at the pub without her. And Julian met the Canadian, and he snogged her. The Canadian was the reason Rosie and Julian broke up.
Julian again lifted his head in protest.
Which sounds worse than it should. Everyone broke up with Julian when he cheated, which was always and with everyone. We broke up, what, 4 times because of that?
It wasn't always me that did the cheating in that case, Suze. The point is, that's how Rosie and Noel ended up together,
Peter summarized. But you didn't recognize her, Izzy said.
I remember the Canadian,
Julian said.
But I didn't recognize her photo.
Julian had a lot of encounters, Suze said.
Suze, can you?
She hung out with me the next night,
Yash said.
She was fun. She was funny. She was really into music. She said she liked being in England because so many of the bands she liked were here. Unlike Julian, I didn't shag everything that moved, so this stood out for me. I really liked her.
She was going to be in England for another day or two, so I lent her some CDs in my bag. I gave her our address so she could visit and bring them back. But she never came. I just thought she took my CDs and went back to Canada.
But she didn't, Suze said. She died. I don't know how Angela put that together or why, but we knew her.
She died punt running, Stevie said. That's a thing?
Oh, yes,
Sebastian said.
Cambridge is on a river, the Cam. The punts are the boats used on the river, mostly by tourists. At night, they're tied up in rows, and people run across them while they're drunk.
How easy is it to fall in?
Very,
Theo said.
It's generally harmless, except the rumor was that you'd get Weil's disease from the water. Leptospirosis. It's not as common as people thought, or else everyone would have had it. You'd be in more danger of snagging yourself on a shopping trolley someone had dumped in the water. But it sounds like she hit her head on the way down, which is also easily done.
It looks like she was found near Grantchester Meadows,
Peter said.
That's between town and where our house was. Yash, she could have been on the way to our place. Maybe with your CDs.
Yash leaned back in his chair and rubbed his forehead.
That's so sad, he said. Oh, God.
So a girl you all met, Stevie said, caused a breakup, disappeared, and drowned a few days before Rosie and Noel died, and could have been on the way to your house when it happened. And on the day you left for Merriweather, an article appears in the paper saying her body has been found. That night, Rosie and Noel were killed. Angela put this part together, and now Angela is gone.
Where is my aunt?
Izzy said. But there was no answer. 24. There had been, to put it mildly, a vibe shift. The whole house was awake. Not just the people. Stevie felt like Merriweather itself had been roused from slumber. She was acutely aware of the faces from the portraits on the wall, the groan and creak of the wood, the autumn wind striking the windows. Her head was thrumming with information as she made her way back upstairs. They'd made a mess of the grand bed. The duvet was piled and almost knotted around a sheet. There were creases where they had sweat and twisted. Stevie smoothed them out and climbed in. David got in beside her and leaned in to kiss her, then sat back.
It's been a weird night, he said.
Yeah, she said. Maybe we can just lay here? He raised his arm, making space for her to tuck herself next to him. He played with her hair as her thoughts drifted over this new information. She wasn't sure how much time passed before she noticed his hand was not moving and he was fast asleep. She propped herself up on her elbow to look at the outline of his face in the darkness for a moment, then slipped out of the bed as silently as she could, grabbing her tablet in the dark, and went into the bathroom. She sat on the sofa under the window. How could she not? Who has a bathroom sofa? The moon was full and white, gleaming the gardens. When Stevie had tried to get into the spirit of a cold case, sometimes she had to immerse herself in sound, something to help her brain slide along. 90s. Britpop. They kept mentioning the band Blur, so she looked it up. She didn't know any of the songs, but there was one called Country House. It started with a bold series of descending chords that sounded like the lead to a party. A very English voice said, "So the story begins." Stevie set it on repeat and let Blur sing into her ears as she looked at every document again. She tried to walk through it in her mind. Samantha Gravis was an American visiting England, just like her. Samantha's time there was limited, like Stevie's. She met the Nine, like Stevie had. She kisses two of them. She borrows CDs from one and gets their home address. It seems like Samantha Gravis, a bit drunk, starts to walk to their house to return the CDs and visit them. It's 1995, so she has no phone to guide her. Maybe she has a map or just some idea of which way to go. It's late. It's dark. Who would have a motive to hurt Samantha? Samantha had kissed Julian and Yash. Julian and Rosie had been dating, and Samantha was the reason they broke up. Did Rosie kill Samantha Gravis? Was that what this was all about? Was that what Angela was referring to? When she said she thought one of her friends was a murderer, did she mean Rosie? And then what? Someone kills Rosie and Noel in retribution? Yash? As they told it, all these people were involved with each other. There was a lot of hooking up and jealousy and breaking up and making up. Anyone could have been mad about what happened. Stevie must have dozed off for a little while. She came to with a start when her tablet fell from her lap and hit the bathroom floor. She snorted away, looked around in confusion at the bathroom and the big tub, and checked the time. It was 5 in the morning. She turned off the music and rubbed her face with both hands. She had no answers. Coffee. She needed coffee. David was fast asleep in the bed as she passed, the massive fluffs of white duvet pulled up to his nose, one arm hanging off the edge of the bed. It was the arm he wore his watch on, the old watch his father had given him. It was a large watch, but David had heavy, strong wrists. Something about seeing his arm outstretched like that. She considered getting back into the bed, waking him with kisses, finishing what they had started. She stood there for a moment, pulled in two directions, then resignedly moved toward the door. There was just so little time and so many questions. Stevie moved along the upstairs hall of Merryweather, past the porcelain bowl and the vases and the grim portraiture. She made her way down the grand staircase, where the ticking grandfather clock stood sentry below. She crossed the wooden floor, smelling the leftover smoke from last night's fire. She made her way back to the massive kitchen and found the lights. The chairs were still pushed out from the table from the conference of a few hours before. She went over to the kettle. She filled it at the sink and put it back on its base, then switched it on to boil. It wasn't a complicated move, but it made her feel like she belonged there. She could fit in there. She could live there. She could go to school there with David. Maybe this could be her life, going to places like this. The kitchen window faced a brick wall. She leaned over the sink a bit to look up at the dark early morning sky. There was a figure reflected in the window behind her. She gasped, even as she realized it was just Nate shuffling in, wearing a large brown hoodie and blue plaid pajama pants and holding his laptop. She nodded. He took a seat, stretching out his legs and spreading them wide.
"Did you figure it all out yet?"
he asked, indicating the kitchen, Merryweather, the mystery, and life in general. Stevie shook her head no. "What's that for?" she asked, nodding toward the computer. "Are you writing?"
"Yep,"
he said a little too quickly. "This is a whole new you," Stevie said. "You used to avoid writing, and now that's all you seem to be doing."
"I just couldn't sleep," he said, setting his computer down.
"We're living in a clue board right now. I heard someone moving around and saw it was you. Probably a good move to be in here. Lots of knives."
She narrowed her eyes at him. It was definitely something. He had his hands resting on his closed laptop, like it might spring open and reveal all his secrets. But Stevie had bigger fish to fry at the moment. Nate's squirrely writing activity would have to be examined another time. "I've been reading over all the stuff Angela got," Stevie said. It doesn't point at anything. Nothing I can see." She bit her lip and shook her head. "Maybe it was a robbery, now that we know what was in the shed."
"Someone came to steal the weed?"
Now that she said it out loud, the idea had a bit of shape to it. Had she been too quick to dismiss it? Was it worth at least looking around outside with that in mind? "Do you want to go for a walk?" she asked.
"Are you being serious right now?"
"I just asked if you wanted to go for a walk."
"Nighttime walk at Axe Murder Manor? For sure. Especially if you heard a noise and want to investigate."
"It's almost dawn," she said.
"It's dark.
Murders don't keep happening at the same place," she said. "They're like lightning. Never strikes twice."
"We literally come from a school where murders kept happening."
"Well, we can't keep going to places where more than one murder happens," Stevie said. "So now we're definitely safe."
"Seriously, no, just wait until the sun comes up."
"We don't have a lot of time," she said.
Anything I'm going to find out, I'm going to find out today. Soon people will be awake, and that's when I'll be able to talk to them. Now's the best time to finish looking at the grounds. Besides, they don't have guns here.
They have axes.
Much slower. Harder to use. She turned off the kettle that she had set on to boil and was now rumbling on its base. She went through to the boot room and looked for the pair of Wellington boots she had worn earlier. She took a coat as well. There were flashlights on a shelf by the door. She grabbed one for herself and one for Nate, who came into the mudroom a moment later.
You know, one of these times I'm not going to follow you,
he said. Really?
I don't know. Maybe.
He sighed and grabbed the nearest barber coat, pulling it on over his hoodie, and accepted the flashlight she held out to him.
Do you think we should bring something?
He said.
Seriously, for safety.
Stevie glanced around and saw a hammer sitting on top of a pile of garden implements and tools under one of the benches. She took it and shoved it into the deep pocket of the coat, as far as it would go. There, she said.
Hammer, Nate said, nodding. Great. Let's take our hammer to the woods.
The door was locked from the inside, so she turned the key and stepped out into the cold. The air was thick with moisture and the smell of leaves and vegetation. The moon was heavy and bright, spilling milky light over the land. They almost didn't need their flashlights. Also, they had experience with being in the woods at night. Ellingham Academy was in the woods on a Vermont mountaintop, much more remote than Merriweather. And they'd spent the summer in the woods looking into a murder. This wasn't all woods, anyway. This was countryside. The tree line broke at points, revealing sprawling fields and lawns and bits of wall. These were all points, Stevie ran through her mind as she gripped the handle of the hammer. It was fine, though. She was pretty sure of it. They walked down the gravel and dirt drive, which was maybe a quarter of a mile long, until they reached the very sturdy wooden entrance gate, which was at least 6 feet high. She consulted the photos on her tablet. It looked to be the same one, or very similar. This gate closes automatically, she said. It's electric. When the power went out at 2:30 that morning, the gate would stop working. It would have to have been pried open, which it wasn't. The road just beyond this gate was blocked off from 3:30 to 7:30 in the morning to fix the power. There's basically no way anyone came here with a car or van. So what do these burglars do? Walk all night in a torrential rainstorm to get here?
Maybe,
Nate said. And no one sees them? Not any of the many people running around the grounds? Just Rosie and Noel, and only at the woodshed? But there's a problem with that as well. Let's just say you're Rosie and I'm a burglar. You discover me or I discover you. I could just run away, but okay, I freak out. I grab an axe, I kill you. Stevie mimed this with the hammer, perhaps a little too closely for Nate's liking. I've killed you. Oh, shit, my bad. What do? I should run now. I don't run. I bury you in wood. I break the glass light bulb sometime around here, so I guess I'm still waving the axe around. Why? Whatever. I take so long that someone else shows up. Again, I don't run. I kill them. She mimed with the hammer from farther away this time, making token gestures. I bury the second person. Why am I waiting around?
Rain? Nate offered. I mean, it's not a great reason.
Stevie shook her head. And these geniuses who walked in the rain to steal a few weed plants and end up committing double murder managed to avoid being seen by anyone else. Except Suze says she saw a flashlight go past the window of the sitting room. But the police just disregard her because she was drunk and because it doesn't fit what they clearly wanted it to fit. And all of it ignores the hard facts that Rosie knew something was wrong and must have seen this article about Samantha Gravis, which appeared in the paper that very morning. No. She shook her head. Now she was more certain than ever. This has an order to it. Samantha Gravis. Rosie. Noel. One leads to the other. Problem leads to problem.
I know an old woman who swallowed a fly, Nate said.
What?
You know that song? We sang it in kindergarten. It's about the old woman who swallowed a fly, and then she swallows a spider to catch the fly, and keeps swallowing progressively bigger crap to deal with the last things she swallowed.
Stevie turned and started walking back. On their right was woods, and on the left, trees and low wall and the opening of the great lawn. As they got nearer to the house, Stevie turned in that direction, climbing over the short bit of stone wall and walking on the grass toward the small pond and the folly. To get there, they had to cross the slender stream that went through the property, but it was only about 2 feet wide and a few inches deep where they were and could be managed with a single stride. Follies came up a lot in murder mysteries. People liked to put bodies under or around them. That made sense, because they were pointless bits of architectural extravagance. What you built if you were a rich, grown-ass adult and wanted a playhouse. Why not build a tiny Greek temple out on the lawn? You'd be weird if you didn't. This folly was made to look like the front of a temple. 4 columns and a peaked roof. It had no inside room. It was just a little overhang, a place to stand out of the sun or rain, maybe have tea or a picnic. I've been reading these witness statements all night, she said. I looked at Angela's notes. She tried to figure out who was where and when. And that's great, but the point is that from about 11 until 2:30 in the morning, pretty much everyone was just somewhere on the grounds, not seen by the others. They pop up here or there, but everyone was out of view except for Sebastian, who was here. He had the keys to the woodshed down his pants. It's pretty on display, huh? Nowhere to hide. Behind them was the pond, which looked to be maybe 3 feet deep at best, and was home to some koi. Stevie watched them glide under the surface. The medical examiner looks at the bodies at about 2 in the afternoon, she went on. They estimated that Rosie and Noel died around the same time, between 11 p.m. until 4 in the morning. So the murders could have happened at any time during the night, and pretty much anyone could have done it. She leaned her forehead against a column. I'm never going to figure this out, she said, mostly to herself. Her breath puffed in front of her, a delicate feather of white mist. It's impossible. I've got a murder mansion, a house full of suspects, a pile of evidence, and nothing. She pushed herself away from the column and walked off to look at the sheep in the fields below. They were already complaining to each other, in long, lowing baas. A few deer poked through the trees and sampled the early morning grass. Nate came up beside her. He was about to take another step when she remembered. Ha ha, she said, clutching his arm. She pointed down. The fuck? He said, looking down at the sheer, unmarked drop. It's supposed to keep the animals away while preserving the view. They call it a ha-ha.
Like that laugh the kid from The Simpsons makes? What is wrong with people?
A lot of things, she replied. She sat down on the ground, letting her legs dangle over the edge. She felt the wet grass soak into the butt of her onesie. It was not designed for this sort of use. Possibly any use. David was asleep upstairs right now. She had so little time left here, but it all seemed so hopeless. Why bother? Because Angela was out there somewhere.
Can we talk about something else for 1 second?
He said, sitting down next to her. She turned in surprise.
Well, since we seem to be in the middle of goddamn nowhere with no one around, and I was planning on... I figured this trip was a good time, and since we're out here at dawn for no particular reason...
Nate was struggling with words, squinting at the pale moon above them. What? She prompted.
Okay,
he said.
You know, like, you and David...
Stevie cocked her head in confusion.
You and David,
he said again.
Vi and Janelle. I don't know if you've noticed, but that's not me.
What's not you?
Romance,
he said.
Being with someone.
I've noticed, she said.
No,
he said.
I mean, ever.
Stevie turned this over in her mind for a second.
I'm saying I'm ace, he said, asexual. I always knew, but I only kind of put the words to it in the last few months.
He went on.
You're the first person I've told.
That Nate was ace wasn't a surprise, really. But him taking her aside to share something this important was. Stevie found herself unexpectedly choking up. She pretended to shift a hair out of her eye to clear a little tear. Nate eyed this sign of emotion warily.
Are you going to tell the others? She asked.
Probably soon, he said. Janelle will probably crochet me an Ace Pride scarf or something.
Ask her to make you an Ace Pride drone.
She would actually do that, wouldn't she?
And she'd knit a little hat for it, Stevie said, nodding.
I'm going to wait until we get back. I can only handle so much of this kind of stuff at once.
He rubbed his eyes sleepily.
We already have a lot going on, but I wanted to tell you while we were here, and this seemed like the right time. I mean, I was up, and you got up, and we're out doing something stupid.
Wait.
Stevie pivoted toward him sharply.
Does this have anything to do with all this writing you're suddenly doing? Did coming out help you start writing again?
Oh my God, he said, rubbing his forehead. Shut up, I'm just writing. I write, I always write.
You don't, Stevie said, half under her breath. But whatever.
Nate inhaled sharply through his nose, and Stevie moved quickly to redirect the conversation. You know how I feel about you, right? She said. Like, if you needed a kidney or something, you should definitely come to me after you've asked everyone else you can think of.
This is why I decided to tell you first, he replied. You're sort of as close as I get to that stuff. That's why I keep following you to second locations.
They exchanged a long look of understanding. Nate, shaggy and lanky and surprisingly strong, the sleeves of his hoodie pulled down over his palms. She couldn't even remember being a Stevie without a Nate. A silver dawn started to bloom. It was misty, droplets of moisture on everything with a gentle light shining through it. Everything had a magical air, softened, as if reality had been put through a soft focus filter. It wasn't daylight yet, but it was coming.
Okay,
he said, getting up.
We're done with feelings, right? Let's go back inside. My ass is freezing.
As soon as Stevie got up and turned back toward the house, she saw a figure striding across the wide expanse of the front lawn in their direction, carrying something in their hands. She felt a jolt of fear and the sudden desire to push Nate off the edge of the ha-ha to safety. This was it. She had taken him out to this remote place and they were going to die. Except it was Theo, carrying two steaming mugs. Unlike Stevie and Nate, she was fully dressed for the day. Jeans, a sweater, a wool coat, and a matching hat.
I saw you through my bedroom window, she said. I always wake up early. Never have been able to sleep in. I thought you might be cold, so I brought you something to warm you up. Americans generally prefer coffee in the morning, I think. I hope instant is all right.
This behavior of Theo's had been recorded in the statements. Theo bringing people tea and water and coffee. Always the doctor, taking care of everyone.
Bit early to be out walking, she said, but it looks like you never went back to bed.
Just thinking everything over, Stevie answered honestly.
I was doing the same, Theo said.
Theo sat down on the stone step of the folly, and Stevie did as well. Nate lurked a bit, leaning against a pillar.
It's a very strange feeling, Theo said. A secret I've been holding all these years, being out in the open at last. What you did last night was impressive. It's so strange. I feel like something's missing. Of course, something, someone, is missing.
Do you have any idea where she might be? Stevie asked.
If I had the slightest clue where Angela was, I'd be there right now, not here.
Because you think she's in trouble, Stevie said.
Theo looked at the ground.
I work in emergency medicine, she finally said. I see so many things every day, from the most mundane to the utterly bizarre. Many things can happen. I don't speculate. I treat the situation as it comes to me. In this case, all I know is that Angela left her house the other night, took the tube to Waterloo, and hasn't been seen since. None of that bodes well.
Do
Do you work nights at the hospital?
I mean, if someone had been brought in?
I work during the day, benefit of seniority. But I checked, believe me. I checked every A&E in London, and I know the police have checked all over the country. Coming here, at least we could be together, support easy, not worry by ourselves.
Theo rubbed her hands together against the morning chill.
Whatever happened, Stevie said, it probably has something to do with what happened here, what she believes happened here.
Was there anything she ever said about it to you, about investigating?
Not about investigating, Theo replied. The only thing she ever said, it was the day we found them, that afternoon. The police interviewed us all, one by one. Angela was cold, shock can do that. So she went upstairs to take a bath. I went up to bring her tea. She was very upset. We all were, obviously. She was having a strong physical reaction to the news, shaking all over. She told me Rosie had pulled her aside when we arrived and wanted to talk to her about something important, but she didn't have the chance. Then Angela started talking about seeing the lock off the door of the woodshed during the game and something about a light inside.
You knew about that? Stevie asked.
You must understand, Stevie. We were all drunk during the night and in shock the next day. I'm not sure how reliable any of our memories or accounts are. I also don't know what Angela's story about the lock means, even if it's true.
She mentioned a button in her text to you all that night, Stevie said. Do you know what she meant?
No idea at all. I'm sure it was a typo. Anyway, there'll be breakfast in an hour or so. Sebastian has enough food in there to feed an army.
With that, she stood and made her way back to the house, with the focused stride of someone who walks the halls of a hospital all day and always has somewhere to be.
Did you get the feeling she didn't just come out here to bring us instant coffee?
Nate asked, holding his face over the hot steam coming off his mug.
I felt like she was trying to tell us something. I mean, there was the stuff about Angela coming to her, but it seemed like something more.
Theo had made it to the low stone steps that rose to the terrace, then passed under the portico and out of sight.
I think, Stevie said slowly, running her gaze over Meriwether's grand facade, that Theo can't sleep because she just realized things in 1995 didn't go down the way she thought they did.
I guess that would be a bad surprise.
I think she's more than surprised, Stevie replied. She's a really smart woman. I think she's terrified. 25. When Stevie got back to her room, she found David was gone. She put her hand on the side of the bed he'd been sleeping in and found that the sheets held a trace of warmth. In the hall, she heard voices and creaking footsteps. Meriwether was waking up. She showered quickly under the luxurious rainfall shower, taking advantage of the fancy products that were stocked in the bathroom. She emerged smelling of gardenias and orange blossom, with her blonde hair wet. She shook it out, pulled on her jeans and hoodie, and made her way back downstairs. Julian was pacing the main hall, talking on the phone and running his hand through his hair.
Yes, I know, Fiona. But the vote is on Tuesday. Yes? Yes, I know.
Morning, said a voice behind her. Suze was coming down the stairs, her curly red hair a halo against the sober dark paneling of the staircase. She wore a petal pink jumpsuit, rolled at the ankles, and white combat boots.
I hope you got some more sleep last night after I woke you, she said.
It may have been Stevie's imagination, but she seemed to linger on the word sleep.
There's coffee and tea in the kitchen, she said, continuing past Stevie and going in that direction.
Yasha and Peter were in the sitting room opposite each other, each with his laptop open and an intent look on his face. Peter had a slouchy way of sitting. He was dressed in jeans and an orange and red striped sweater that made his own golden red hair stand out. He had such a heavy-lidded expression that he looked like he might be falling asleep, but Stevie could see his eyes were intently focused on Yash.
Yash was dressed in a hoodie and sweatpants and was making a gesture that was either a mime of playing trombone or something obscene.
"And then we say something about him being a prick," he said.
"That's too obvious," Peter replied.
"What about something about letting the dogs out?" Yash countered.
"We made that joke 3 weeks ago."
"It wasn't that exact joke."
"Close enough."
"So it's a callback," Yash said.
"That's not a callback. That's just a repeated joke."
Yash reached up and rubbed his curly hair in thought. Someone else was coming down the steps now. Stevie turned to find Nate, dressed in a stretched-out black turtleneck and a worn pair of jeans. His hair was also wet, stuck across his forehead.
"Hey,"
he said, tapping his fingers on the banister.
"What are you doing?"
"Just watching," she said. "I guess that's what writing looks like." Yash noticed that he and Peter had a small audience and waved Stevie and Nate into the sitting room. It had a strange feel in the morning. The chairs were too low and soft, the drapes too thick, the glasses and trays of drinks not appropriate for the hour.
"This is how jokes get written," Yash explained. "I make offerings, and he insults them."
"Edits them," Peter replied.
Yash gestured as if to say, "You see?"
"In this case," Peter said, "we've got a government minister who keeps cheating on his spouse and getting caught. This is the third time this year. And we've got to come up with new jokes about him."
Behind them, Julian was pacing the cavernous hall again, still talking about an upcoming vote.
"Oh, not Julian," Yash said, sensing the direction Stevie was looking. "Not this time, but we've written jokes about Julian for the show, too."
"We had years of material stored up for that," Peter added.
He shut his laptop with finality.
"Bugger if I know what to write right now. Let's continue after breakfast."
There was a general movement toward the kitchen, where Sebastian, Theo, and Suze were all engaged in different activities. Theo was on the phone, talking doctor talk about a patient.
"Well, I did send a message to neurology, but no one got back to me. Has the blood work come back yet?"
Suze sipped a coffee and paged through the glossy color supplement from the newspaper on the table. Sebastian, meanwhile, ran from stove to fridge to sink to counter, managing all the pans and trays he had going. The air was thick with good smells, frying bacon and sausages, some savory scents that she could not place.
"Have you had a full English?"
Sebastian asked cheerfully.
"It's a cultural icon. Eggs, bacon, sausage, beans, tomatoes, mushrooms, and the most important..."
He held up something that appeared to be dark salami.
"Black pudding," he said.
"Pudding?"
Nate asked.
"It's not pudding," Suze said, wrinkling her nose. "It's made of blood. There are veggie sausages as well, for those of us who don't want to eat congealed pig's blood."
"Pig's blood and spices. It's delicious."
"Yum,"
Nate said grimly. Suze nodded agreement.
"Don't be put off," Sebastian said. "It's a national classic. Yash, grab the bacon from under the broiler, would you? Peter, the mushrooms and tomatoes are in the slow oven down there. Nate, Stevie, would you mind taking those teacups and plates through to the dining room?"
Stevie and Nate each grabbed a stack of crockery and brought it through. As they dropped them off, Stevie picked up an empty wine bottle that was still on the table from the night before. She considered it for a moment.
"It's a bottle," Nate said.
"Hold it up to your ear and you can hear the vineyard."
Stevie kept looking at the bottle for a long moment, setting it down when the parade of breakfast foods came through the door. Yash wrangled a platter of still-spitting sausages and bacon. Peter carried the tomatoes and beans and mushrooms. Suze kept the plant-based food away from the black pudding and animal grease that was going everywhere. Sebastian brought up the rear with platters of eggs and racks of toast.
"Get Theo and Julian, won't you?"
he asked Suze. Suze went off, and a moment later her trained voice rang through the entirety of Merriweather, curling through the hall and slipping under doors.
"Would you like to learn something about country house etiquette?"
Sebastian asked them.
"Meals were always served at table by servants, except for breakfast. One always serves oneself at breakfast from the sideboard. I'm doing it that way because I am lazy and cannot be buggered to serve these layabouts, and everyone likes a buffet.
Theo reappeared, looking harried.
They're having a nightmare of a morning at A&E, she said. I had to explain I was out of town. I'm starving.
Janelle and Vi appeared, summoned by a text from Nate. David took a moment longer, and Izzy was last. This was curious, but Stevie shook it off. Julian still had not appeared.
Always the last one,
Sebastian said.
Must be off saving the country, Peter said.
I'll text him, Theo said.
Anyway, let's start.
Everyone filled up their plates and took a seat.
What are your plans? Suze asked them.
We have to go back to London today, Janelle said with a subtle side eye at Stevie. It's our last day in England. We fly home tomorrow.
Do you have something enjoyable planned for the last night?
Sebastian said. Tea, Vi replied, at a hotel in Soho. And then we're going to see Richard III at the Barbican.
Oh, Suze said. I've got three friends in that production. I could text them and let them know you're coming. They could show you around backstage if you'd like.
What about you, Izzy?
Sebastian said gently.
You're welcome to stay here with us,